Welcome to Stargate SG-1 for the first time. Still not a Star Trek podcast. My name is Jeff Aiken, and I'm watching Stargate SG-1 for the first time.
And I'm Brent Allen, and I'm watching Stargate SG-1 for the 47th time. Jeff and I are two veteran Star Trek podcasters who joined forces to bring you Babylon 5 for the first time. And we had so much fun doing that. And we had so many requests from the folks out there. We decided to do it again with Stargate.
And this is still not a Star Trek podcast by any means. And so we like to play games here on the For the First Time series of podcasts and shows. And the original game, the OG, is the Rule of Three. This limits us to no more than three references to Star Trek per episode.
That's it. Three. One of those three. No substitutions, exchanges, or read.
And it's awesome to make those references because then I get to play this sound.
But there's a better sound. Because whenever we make a Babylon 5 reference now, since that's really our main jam right now, you're going to hear.
Oh, yes.
All right, Brent, we are watching The Torment of Tantalus this week. I don't remember what I predicted this to be. I think I pulled out something super vague.
You said something. I do remember you said something about Daniel Jackson having like being like he's trying to reach for some, trying to grasp something, and it's just out of his reach.
That's right.
But you kept it super vague.
I learned from the best.
How's that crown fitting over there?
Right. Why don't you tell us about this one?
Well, this is episode 11 of season one, The Torment of Tantalus. Fun enough, we talked about this last week. In Greek mythology, Tantalus, whom this particular episode is named after, was the father of Pelops, who was the Goa'uld from two episodes ago in Brief Candle. The two really don't have a connection, Jeff, at all. The original air date for this episode was October 3rd, 1997. Jeff, this is the first of only two episodes that is going to be directed by show creator Jonathan Glassner.
Okay.
And it will also feature as a guest actor in this episode, an actor who will eventually come back in a different role as a series lead, a series regular on Stargate Atlantis.
Okay. Okay, cool.
So fun. Fun to see that. We've certainly seen that before in Star Trek and other places, you know.
Here in about 4 years, I'll get to see that.
Hopefully it's not that long. Hopefully it's not.
There's a lot of Stargate SG-1 is a lot to this show.
It's about twice of what Babylon 5 is, and that's just SG-1. But who knows where we might start mixing in Atlantis, if we're going to even do Atlantis.
Right. Who knows?
Anyway, Jeff, why don't we go ahead and jump into this episode, Torment of Tantalus. For those of you playing along at home, the way this works is Jeff and I are going to go watch this episode right now. Like, we're going to do it right now. We're going to pause the creation of this podcast, and we're going to go watch the episode. Now, if you're watching with us on YouTube, you're going to get the reaction video because we're going to record a reaction video. That's going to come up right now. And if you want to see the full unedited reaction, well, head over to our Patreon page, patreon.com/Babylon5First.
And if you're one of our amazing listeners on a podcasting app like Apple Podcasts or whatever else is out there these days, CastBox and all that good stuff, we're going to break right here and you're going to hear some stuff that happens. I'm not sure what it is. It's in the middle there. And when we come out of that, you're going to get to hear my first time reaction, my thoughts having watched this for the first time. And then you're going to get to hear Brent's take on any of the sci-fi messages that he was able to pull out of this one.
Which is my first time. I'm watching for the first time for those messages. I've never watched this show for all the times I've seen it. I've never intentionally watched for those messages. So that's what I'm doing in this.
And we've found some pretty great stuff and surprising stuff so far. So what do you say? Let's dive into The Torment of Tantalus and see what you get out of this one.
Let's go.
Chevron 7 locked.
The year is 1945. It's been nearly 20 years since the Stargate was found at a dig in Giza. A group of scientists are tinkering around the gate, rotating the dialing ring, randomly locking in chevrons. I mean, it's like a 1 in a million chance that these guys are ever going to find a working set of chevrons, but somebody must have bought a lottery ticket that week because they are about to get lucky. The gate whooshes open. They can't believe it. They see a pool of standing water. They get a guy dressed up in a diver suit, fishbowl helmet and all, and they send him through the gate.
And just as he enters, he vanishes. The gate shuts off, severing his breathing line with it. As real life fades into black and white footage being watched by Daniel and Jack, we shift to the present day. They are amazed to discover that despite all the reports to the contrary, the gate had in fact been opened before. The good news is, we just so happen to know someone who was alive back then who just might know something about this. Cue another character from the movie making her way back into the show, Catherine Langford. Catherine was the elderly lady who recruited Daniel Jackson into the Stargate program almost 2 years ago. She had been the leader of the Stargate program until the military took over and shuttered the program and then brought it back and nobody thought to call her. Catherine's involvement with the gate, though, goes back much further than that, all the way to her childhood. You see, she was actually a little girl present at the dig led by her own father when the Stargate was discovered. You see, it was her father who was in charge of the Stargate program, at least until the footage that we saw at the beginning of the episode, a time when Catherine was now a young woman, and she absolutely knows who it was that went through that gate all those years ago, Ernest Littlefield. And Ernest was her fiancé. Only Catherine didn't know that he went through the gate. All that she was told was that Ernest died during an explosion in the lab. But now she knows the truth. Daniel opts to bring Catherine back to the SGC, a move which does not please General Hammond. After all, she's just a civilian who has been made aware of classified information. But pishin' fiddlesticks. She's literally been around since the beginning, for crying out loud. So Hammond decides to let her stay. Later, in a briefing, Daniel reveals that they were able to see which chevrons were used in the footage. So they can still go to that planet and see whatever became of Ernest Littlefield. Sam says that that address, though, is not found on the cartouche at Abydos, which means that this is a planet that the Goa'uld do not know about, which means, wait for it, the Goa'uld were not the original builders of the Stargate. Dun, dun, dun! And Teal'c says, well, duh. Also, what if there's some tech there that the Goa'uld don't know about? That's all very interesting, but Catherine really misses her boyfriend, and she is not about to let a last chance to do a bit of gate travel herself pass by. So, we all suit up and we're all going. Flash forward to the planet. It's a stormy day out. A crumbling castle sits on a crumbling hill, and the crumbling bluffs over a rather ominously violent ocean. This castle houses the Stargate on this planet. After a brief moment of getting their bearings, a man emerges from the shadows. An elderly man. A naked elderly man. Doing his best Luke Skywalker impression from the end of Force Awakens. Well, Sam discovers that the DHD is broken, which accounts for why Ernest was never able to leave the planet. She's going to work on that while we explore the rest of the castle. And Catherine and Ernest are going to catch up a little bit. They're rather standoffish at first. Ernest isn't so sure that she's even real. Catherine is understandably pissed at him. Why? Because they were engaged and he did such a stupid and dangerous thing without checking with her first. And that, kids, is how a loving and long-lasting marriage is supposed to work. Fortunately, true love transcends time and distance, and they eventually begin to warm up to each other again. While they're doing that, Daniel discovers Ernest's journal, and through that, discovers a room with a weird device sitting in the middle of it. All around the room are writings, but they appear to be written in four very different alien languages. Using the journal, Daniel turns it on, and it suddenly projects a light show into the air. And with the lightning quickness of a 43-minute episode of television, we surmise that these projections are in fact atoms forming elements on the periodic table, some of which we haven't even discovered yet. Which of course means that these are all the basic building blocks of all matter in the universe. Which of course means that this is how the ancient aliens ensured universal communication. Which of course means that this place must have been a meeting place, a United Nations of the Stars, if you will. And each of these languages on the wall must represent what was once four great alien races, of course. Well, that's all fine and dandy, but back in the other room where Sam and Teal'c are working on that broken DHD, the castle and the cliffs crumble, sending the DHD falling into the ocean below. Well, now how are they supposed to get home? Fortunately for them, there's a storm outside, and Sam calculates that the exact amount of energy needed to manually dial the gate is 1.21 gigawatts. If they can somehow funnel the lightning into the flux capacitor just as the Stargate hits 88 miles per hour, they'll go back to the future. Or, well, to Earth. but they probably better get a move on because this castle is really starting to crumble, like a lot. They make quick work of putting that plan into action, but no, Daniel doesn't want to go. This is the archaeological find of a lifetime. Forget the Stargate program. Forget exploring other planets. Forget his mission to find his wife and bring her home. He just wants to stay here. But Ernest reasons with Daniel. What good is learning all of this knowledge if you have no one to share it with? Nothing. Trust me, I know. And with that, they all gate back home. And even though they can't reestablish a wormhole to this world again, likely due to the gate having fallen in the ocean and been buried, they do have Ernest's journal, which has rather extensive notes. And with that, Ernest and Catherine ride up the elevator again, off to have that life together they never got to have before. Oh, and Catherine has so many plans to introduce Ernest to her children and her grandchildren and her great-grandchildren and show him pictures of the man she actually married instead of him. Just to rub it in his face that he shouldn't have gone through the gate like that in the first place without checking with her. All right, Jeff, that was Torment of Tantalus. We've just watched it like 30 seconds ago. Finish the episode. You are hot off the presses. Jeff, what you got?
Fresh as can be. Dude, I loved this episode.
I thought you might.
So good. You know, when... In our watch of Babylon 5, there are episodes that we get done and we're like, how did they fit 2 hours of content into 44 minutes, right?
Oh, yes.
That's this episode. I feel like this was a film. The story they told, the emotions they took us through were incredible. At the beginning of this episode, I knew the little bit about Catherine you had told me. Within minutes, I was begging for the dude who went through the Stargate to be the dude that left her so we could have a reunion. And then we almost got it till he no-sold her and just took off. You know, it's like, what's going on?
Right, right.
I loved it because it set up so many things that just looked like, oh, everything's just going to work out and it's going to be fine. You know, when you think about it, Daniel went to find Catherine, tried to talk her, you know, learn some stuff from her and then talk her into coming to check stuff out. That worked out really well. Came in, General Hammond's all mad at him, but Jack makes it fine, and Hammond's actually fine. Everything's just going fine, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then stuff starts falling apart, and it starts when Ernest is like, eh, Catherine, eh, and takes like, whoa, what's going on here, you know? And some of it got predictable, right? Like I was able to, I knew pretty early on this place is going to start falling apart the way that they were teasing out the sounds and the physical stuff. The need that, so they're out of power and the fact that there's this lightning storm building up. Oh, okay. We're going to have to do the Back to the Future thing and do the lightning.
Right. Right.
But I mean, that's TV, right? You set the stuff up and you pay it off. Yeah, it was excellent. It was so fun, but there's so much lore in this episode. Like I'm just going to go through a couple of bullets I have here. So they were running experiments on the gate in 1945. Use, and it was Catherine's dad who first discovered it in the 20s?
2028, I believe, was the year we were given.
Yeah. And do we know that from the movie?
I believe so. I think it's from the movie. I think they have said 1928 in the show once or twice, but don't quote me on that.
Okay.
But I think that, like, that's the number that sticks out in my head. By the way, don't do the math on it where she's like, I was 21 and this was it and I was 10 there. Don't do it. Just... It's okay.
So that's kind of a big deal. I guess in my head, I thought that the discovery, I thought everything around the Stargate started with the movie. Like they discovered it and it was a new thing. I didn't realize at this point that like she was running a research thing on it and there was work and that it went back that far.
So from the movie, just so you know, basically the opening scene of the movie is Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark. The guys doing King Tut's tomb, like it's that feel in Egypt.
Okay.
Somebody comes running and like, we found something. And they go, you know, the white guy, who's the boss, who he walks out there and they go see something. And next thing we know, they've got all these ropes around this big circular object and they pull it up and there's a Stargate. And here's this little girl running around and she has this necklace on. And then the movie flashes forward. And we see this older lady who still has this necklace,
mm-hmm.
and it's today, you know, and so that's really the, what, we're not given in the movie what happened between one or the other. It's just she was the little girl on the dig way back when, and now she's running the program. This episode actually gave us some of what was going on back then.
Yeah, it fills in a lot of the past, which is cool. I like the way they formatted the episode too, where it would just kind of phase in and out of some flashbacks. And I think that was part of what made this feel bigger than it was. Like, the episode never rushed. It spent time in all of these different places. Like, we talked about, you know, the dad. Like, we felt stuff from the dad in the couple seconds, you know, that we got to see him. So, I mean, they really maximized all the screen time. This planet that they found here that they were able to dial in that first time wasn't on the cartouche they found at Abydos. So uncharted, you know, essentially, you know, unknown. They said that means
unknown to the Gould.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's what they were saying. That means that the Gould have not found it yet. And they said a thing, I forget who said it, might have been Daniel, that kind of picks up on the Thor's hammer theme of trying to really find evidence that the Gould did not build the Stargates. So I think that it's like, it's a theory that they're feeling is probably right, but they're looking for that evidence for it. Let's see, more of the lore. I found it interesting, though. Kind of one of my questions here was, so it's Heliopolis, which is very Egyptian. Abydos, Egyptian. Abydos, though, ruled by Gould gods. No Gould over here. So, like, where's the crossover that brings the Egyptian stuff?
Yeah, I was actually thinking about that in this episode. I think when Ernest mentioned Heliopolis, he wasn't saying this is Heliopolis. I think he was just saying this is like Heliopolis. And Daniel was like, oh, because Heliopolis was a meeting place of the minds where people got to get them together and discuss stuff. And oh, yeah, they actually used to worship Ra. And they just sort of let that go in the episode, which is fine. Didn't matter. But I think it was more, I don't think it was this is Heliopolis as much as, think about Heliopolis, that's what I think this place was.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Before we gate into the rest of this episode, did you know you're missing most of the content from this podcast? Stargate SG-1 for the first time has an active and exciting Patreon that you can join right now by clicking the link in the show notes. Not only will you get access to the full, unedited podcast and reaction videos, you'll also be able to join a growing, vibrant, maybe even an intergalactic community. Subscribers even get access to all of our content from Babylon 5 for the first time. Don't miss out on this content and the amazing people. Just click the link in the show notes. Tilk thinks you should do it right now.
Indeed.
More simile than metaphor.
I think similes and metaphors are pretty much the same. More metaphor than real life, than actual.
But a simile set would say,
like,
yeah, my microphone is like a can, and a metaphor would be this microphone is a can.
Is a can, yeah.
So there you go. There's your lesson, everybody. You learned something here today. But that was the other piece of lore that came out of this was this apparently, based on the languages that were there and the evidence that Ernest was able to find, four alien groups came together in this meeting place and worked some stuff out. What they worked out, we don't know.
Like a United Nations of sorts, they said.
We don't know what they were working out. We know that they were using we have the assumption that they were using a universal language based on chemistry, which, and I said this during the reaction, so I'm not going to buzz myself again, but that was basically the entire plot to season 4 of Star Trek Discovery.
Only I think they did it better here. No offense to Discovery.
They did it better here and in a fraction of the time.
Yeah, well, you know.
They made a point of noting the Norse language that was up on the walls and bringing us back again to the fact that Thor was an alien. Like, they said it in an episode. They followed it up in an episode. I feel like they're wanting us to be sure that we understand that. And I feel like at the end, they kind of talk about...
I'm sorry. And not just that Thor was an alien, but that Thor's race is one of these four ancient races. And what we also learned from last week's episode was that race, that at least that one race, no, we don't know about these others, but that one race, they are way more powerful than the Gould, or at least we assume they are, like,
from what we know. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, look what they could do. And they're like, we told the system lords, they got to stay out of this place by this decree, not an agreement, by this decree.
Yeah.
Subsection, whatever. And you violated it and now you die.
And I think what's important there too is that subsection from the system lords specifically said the Gould. So like, if we start piecing some things together, the Gould haven't found this place, but the Norse gods, the aliens, were involved in this. I can start really seeing how the Gould came up and are really seen as just like this pest, this infestation that's awful. And they're like locusts, right? You don't check them, they'll take over, they'll kill everything in their path. But if you check them, like which we saw with Thor's hammer, then you're fine. Like, you just got to kill them. Just got to squash these things. But in most of the galaxy, they're running around unchecked because these four, I'm going to call them the first four, that kind of put this stuff together. I think that the way they kind of set it up at the end of the episode, where again, they talked about what they learned and these four aliens, the first four, which I think is now going to give kind of an overarching story throughout the series as they try to find them, so that they can then come back together as the final four.
Okay.
Last big thought on this one. This episode did a great job hitting the emotional highs and lows, and the soundtrack was perfectly executed. The music was perfect. The timing was perfect. That build up. You got Ernest, you know, like understanding these people are real, and he's looking at him and out of focus, a little ways away is Catherine just watching. That just kept her so present through this whole thing, but he wasn't seeing her. And then like you get the build up to them coming, and it's like, oh, and it pays off, you know, way at the end. It's like, oh my God, and you feel that. And it was just, yeah, it was excellent. I really enjoyed and appreciate the construction of this episode.
Jeff, let me ask you, how would you be if you were alone for 50 years and then all of a sudden people showed up? I totally get why Ernest was a little bit like, I don't know if you're real or not. I don't really know that I have words to say anything. I can talk, but I don't. Here, I wrote all this down. Just read that. Like,
no, I think for my Star Trek podcast, the Starfleet Leadership Academy, I watched the Voyager episode one.
Love that episode.
It's so great. I do a couple things in the Starfleet Leadership Academy. Primarily, I'm trying to extract leadership and management lessons from this whole thing. And part of what I got in this one, this doesn't happen often, where I had a plan of what I was going to talk about, but I ended up, like, the story took me in an entirely different direction. If you're not familiar with the episode, Voyager is going through this part of space that's toxic to most everyone on the ship. They got to put him in these stasis pods. So you've got the Doctor, who's a hologram, and Seven of Nine, who's an ex-Borg, and so she's more or less immune to the effects of this.
She's got the nanites that protect
her. Kind of heal it all up. But they have to keep the ship on course and make sure it gets through this whole thing.
And it's going to take a lot, like...
It was a month. No, it's like a month.
It was just a month? Okay. Yeah, it was a long time to like get through.
Well, and what happened is she started losing her mind, and there was other, you know, there was Star Trek-y stuff going on, but I was really struck in that episode about how she spent a month, 30 days on her own, and was on the verge of self-harm and destruction of the ship because the walls between fantasy and reality were so shaken for her. Mm-hmm. And when I was talking about that, I went to... Here in the United States, we have a barbaric, inhumane practice in our prison systems of solitary confinement. You don't do a good job, you're going to go in the box. And like literally sometimes it's a box and we leave people in there for weeks, months. There's places that people have been left in there for years. And in every single case, there is extreme damage, physical damage to the brain. And then that, you know, manifests in personalities and mental health. And just, I mean, it is arguably the worst thing you can do to another person is isolate them.
But think about this. Okay. In parenting. Okay. We're not allowed to spank our kids anymore. Right.
Yeah.
Kids get old enough. Now I know this happened to me when I was a teenager. I've got a kid who's about old enough, and this is the most effective thing I can do to him. What do I do when he misbehaves? You're grounded.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. It's horrible.
If he can't go see his friends for 2 or 3 days, he's now sometimes having the break for a day or two isn't bad, but like he needs to get out and go see his kids. Like he's got to go be with his boys. Like
we need that. We are a communal species, you know, and it's necessary for us. So in that episode, I went down that path and I learned so much about the dangers, the long lasting effects of solitary confinement. There's recent studies coming out now, especially in the aftermath of the initial response to COVID, about specifically in men, but in general, the new epidemic, the pandemic that we're dealing with of a couple, but is the pandemic of loneliness.
Yeah.
And there's a study, I forget who did it. I feel bad I'm citing the study and I can't tell you where it's from. You can look it up. You just type in what I'm going to say, but they say that for most men, at least in the United States, being lonely, the level of loneliness that many of them are experiencing is the equivalent to your physiology in your body as smoking a pack and a half of cigarettes a day.
Wow.
Just being lonely. So when I take all of that and I lay it over 50 years, a lot of this episode falls apart because dude should not have had even an inch left of, in reality. He should have been so far gone that he wasn't able to connect, at least not in the amount of time that they had. You even said during the reaction, you know, because at first he was kind of stuttery a little bit and having trouble getting the words out. And then all of a sudden he was great. Like he just got it. And they were there for 20 minutes. That's not how it's going to go. That guy's going to go through some intense treatment and therapies before he's even communicating on a regular basis. So how would I do? I wouldn't survive it. I would not survive 50 years alone.
Yeah, I don't know that I would either.
So that's my first reaction, initial reaction to this whole thing. I really dug it. I'm just going to, spoiler alert, I'm really anxious about the ranking on this one because I got feelings, but there have been some other great episodes in this season. So, but before we get to that, Brent, you watched this episode for the first time with the lens of what kind of sci-fi messages are buried in this or apparent in this. So why don't you tell us what you got out of your experience viewing this one?
You know, I actually have a whole list of notes.
I'll bet.
Going from all the way from Catherine talking about her dad protecting her and why he lied to her to all of these things and Daniel and in his moment deciding, you know, whether or not to let them shoot the thing and all that sort of stuff. And then it all comes boiling down. I love when shows do this. They boil it all down into one tiny phrase that is perfect. Ernest Littlefield says this: no prize is worth attaining if you cannot share it. There is no point. That is a lesson that we should all do well to learn. This was the lesson that it's different from Daniel's lesson from last week. I know you compared this a lot to Daniel from last week, where Daniel had to make the choice to shoot the Thor's hammer in order to save Teal'c. And this time he had to make the choice to at least stand aside while they destroyed this thing that meant a whole lot. And he said, I'm willing to stay behind. And Jack goes, I'm not willing for you to stay behind.
Yeah.
You know, cause Jack cares about Daniel. It takes a smart person, a brave person to know what's really important in life. For Ernest, he learned the hard way that he should not have chosen his curiosity over his love, his career over what would have been his family. Catherine was bitter and chose to live with bitterness. Even if she thought he was dead, there was still something in her that flickered real fast, right?
Well, she explicitly said she never forgave him.
Yeah. And again, Daniel was about to risk his life to stay behind, knowing the likelihood was that he would be trapped. And yeah, you could just come back and get me. No, we can't, because the whole gate might be gone. And you know what? We don't have cool ships to fly over here and get you. But he's like, I don't care. No, because no prize is worth attaining if you cannot share it. Otherwise, there is no point. Jeff, a long time ago, I was a stand-up comedian.
Yes.
I did that for several years. I was a relative newlywed. My wife was pregnant when I went to my very first open mic.
Wow.
And we had this conversation, you know, and I told her then, and I'll tell her again, and I've said this before, and this has been an overriding thing. They're never going to make a biopic about me, because I'm not going to be the guy who starts doing this thing, has some talent, goes out and does a thing and blows up, but he loses his family in the process and then has to find redemption on the other side. Cause that's the way every biopic goes, right?
Yep.
I said, I'm not going to be like that. I'm not going to do that. My family is always going to come first. And if anything ever interferes with this, then that's gone. The number of opportunities that I had, now I did a couple of very small tours, nothing huge. But the number of opportunities that I had while I was doing that. And eventually I had to stop because frankly, every time I was out with the club, I was like, I would always get into the, oh, we could do this. We could do this. I could go here. We could make this happen. And then I'd have to stop and go, but I have this governor. Like I have my wife and my family and they are first because they were my priority. Actually, I guess it would have been my third podcast, show called The Pewtercast. It was covered the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. That show blew up.
It's big.
It was huge. It was huge. It still is in many ways. It was in a time when sports podcasting was still a new thing. And it really led the way. We got to work with the NFL and helping to define what media is, new media. And, you know, think about it, the NFL owns a day of the week. If they start saying this is media, guess what? Because media is changing. Anyway,
it's what it is.
We got to do the thing. The show was amazing. The show was going great. It was at its height. And my kid came to me one day. He was, I don't know, 8, 9 years old. And he says, and we, you know, I always read to him before he goes to bed. He said, Daddy, you going to read to me tonight? I said, sorry, buddy, I can't tonight because I have to podcast.
Mm.
And I felt myself throwing up in my mouth as I said that. And I was walking upstairs to go do the show, I said, I am never saying that to him again. And it was later that night that I told my co-host, I'm leaving the show.
Wow.
The show that I started, my baby. And it was 100,000% because of my son. And boy, I'm going to keep this first. I am lucky that I had a wife who helped me. This wasn't just Brent made a decision and Brent's a hero. No. I had a wife who was like, you know, you're not doing this, right? You know, we're keeping this in, you know, and I love her. She is by far the better half of this whole deal. And I'm so thankful that she didn't just lay down the rule. Like it was a discussion we had. I'm thankful that she helped me keep my priorities straight. And she has this whole time. She's always helped me keep my priorities straight. And I'm glad that I have, because no podcast is worth having if I can't share it with the joy of not just a co-host, but my family.
Day one for us, rule number one.
Yeah.
Was this podcast will never supersede anything in our personal lives. And both of us, various times during the year and a half or so we've been doing this, last minute, hey, not tonight. Daughter needs something. Oh, kid this, wife this. Cool. No problem.
Every time. It's not even a question
because we established this from go. To your
part of the DNA of this show. But the point of that being, I love this phrase. No prize is worth attaining if you can't share it. At some point you've got to be responsible. At some point you've got to know what is actually valuable and what is not. It may not be your career. It may not be your curiosity of what's going on through there. What was Catherine's whole did you catch it? What was her whole deal with Ernest? Was it that he went through the gate way back when?
No, it was that he picked his career over her.
He didn't tell her. He didn't even talk to her about it. That's what it was. That when she boiled it down, she was like, he went and did this and didn't even discuss it with me. She probably would have been all for him going. He would have, you know, like there probably would have been whatever, but she would have been a part of that. She might have been able to figure something out and help keep the gate going and go get him back. But, you know, they shut her out. So,
yeah.
Anyway, that's what I'm going to go with on this one is that line. No prize is worth attaining if you can never share it. Otherwise, there is no point. So the question falls to me is how many chevrons? How strong is that message on a scale of 0 to 5 chevrons? Jeff, I think ultimately that's what this episode was about. Everything flew to that one. I mean, it all pointed from Catherine's story to Ernest's story, both sides of it. They presented a problem. They discussed it. We showed it. They showed us both sides of it and how it goes wrong with Ernest and Catherine. And then you put Daniel right in the middle of a similar situation. And he had to make that decision and listen to the old folks say, don't do this. Hey, you could also probably pull another message of listen to those who've gone before you.
Right.
I've had a lifetime. Trust me on this one. Yeah, I think this is a five chevron episode, Jeff. Like, because it went to that. Like, were they intentional about this and put it to that spot? Yes, they did.
It was built. The whole point of this was that.
And we got all that other stuff you talked about in your spot.
Right. There's so much in this episode. And I think, like, the whole listening to the people who've gone before you, there's so many pieces of wisdom that are just part of our vernacular, right? We just know. Mm-hmm. Clearly, in this episode shows we don't take to heart. The one that I'm thinking here is, what is the one thing every person bemoans or complains about or regrets on their deathbed? Spending time with their loved ones. No one is like, oh, I should have discovered that thing. I should have wrote that thing. I should have put in the hours. They're like, I wish I would have spent more time with the people I care about.
Yeah.
We've all heard that. But you know what we're all doing? We're all writing that thing. We're all recording the podcast. We're all putting in the extra hours at the expense of the thing that we know we're going to regret not spending our time with. Listen to the people who came before us.
And just to be clear, there's nothing wrong with writing that thing or doing that podcast or discovering that thing. You just can't do it at the expense of. And it doesn't mean that that other thing dominates everything else. You pull it into conjunction. It's an interdependence. Anyway, Jeff, before we go any further, we do want to update our tracking sheet. We are tracking a few things over the course of the show just for funs, for poops and giggles, shall we say. We got a crying out loud in this episode, which brings my tracking total up to 7.
Look at that.
But that brings us up to 7. We got one Daniel death on the screen, and we're still waiting on a few of the others to kick in for number 1. Jeff, that being said, I gave this one 5 chevrons. I rated this episode. You, sir, get to rank this episode. You get to place this episode on our 100% completely accurate, immutable ranking of season 1 of Stargate SG-1. Our top 5 currently, Jeff, is the Nox sitting all the way up at top at number 1. Cold Lazarus sitting at number 2. Brief Candle at number 3. The Broken Divide at number 4. And I believe this is probably the week where Children of the Gods is going to get pushed out of the top 5. Jeff, what you got for us?
You know, I look at the top 3, the top 2 specifically, and I feel like...
Say top 3? No.
Look at the top 2 here. Well, I was just going to say, I look at that, and I think in terms of, like, the Nox, I feel like at this point in the viewing thing, the community is probably like, yeah, that's probably the right call. I feel good on that. Cold Lazarus, people don't feel so good about. Like, that's a
it's Jeff, your TKO of...
Right? 100%. This is the thing that spoke to me in a way.
No, but you know, I'm sorry. Can I defend the Cold Lazarus thing? Because I never would have put it up at number 2, but you made a really good point. It is not a fun episode. It's not one we want to watch again, but it is incredibly poignant, which makes it a great episode that I just don't really ever want to watch. Mm-hmm. So
this, though, The Torment of Tantalus. So what I said about Cold Lazarus is poignant. It made me feel like I felt in that episode. Torment of Tantalus made me feel, and it made me feel so many things. Roller coaster of emotions. Also, it was super entertaining. It was super educational around what this whole Stargate thing is. This had everything. This episode did more to immerse me in the world of Stargate than even Children of the Gods did. Brent, this is our new number 1 episode.
Has to be. Yeah, absolutely. I agree. And that is no knock on the Nox, because I love that episode as well. But
it's almost like the number 1 episode is the Torment of Tantalus, and then the Nox is actually number 8. Like, there's that much of a divide between, and maybe not number 8, but like, this episode sits high above, in my opinion, what we've seen so far. I don't mean that as a negative on the Nox or Cold Lazarus or the Broken Divide or anything else. It's just like this one, this is a different tier of episode.
This, I've often thought if I gave this show the Beam Me Up treatment,
mm-hmm.
which for those of you who don't know, my Star Trek podcast was Beam Me Up. And in that episode, basically the challenge was, is how do I boil down over 800 plus episodes to about 150 or so of the most important, not the best, but the most important episodes. And I've often thought that if I were to do that with this show, this would probably be the, like there's the pilot and then it would be this show, this episode. Cause I don't think anything else, like as much as I love the Nox, I don't think it really hits maybe Thor's Hammer might.
It's got some lore, right? That I'm assuming is going to, well, it is going to come up again because they brought Thor up again. So
yeah, maybe not Thor's Hammer. It's reasons.
And well, I was going to say, you and I know, I helped chart the course for two of the seasons that you looked at with you. And there were those episodes where we're like, hey, this is good. It introduces this thing and that's important. But actually two seasons down the road, it does a better job doing this. So let's drop this one. You should probably.
And they're going to tell you everything you learn in this episode and that episode down there. And we're actually going to watch that episode anyway. So we can skip this one. Yeah, that's kind of Thor's Hammer right now to me. Like, I love the episode. I actually really enjoy Thor's Hammer a lot, apparently more than you did. But yeah,
Thor's Hammer was a great 30-minute episode.
Which, you know, compared to Torment of Thanos, where he said it's just 2 hours packed into 42 minutes.
That felt like 30 minutes, like it was that well done. Yeah.
Well, Jeff, I think that's going to do it for us here, talking about Torment of Tantalus. Next time, the name of our episode is Bloodlines. Dun, dun, dun. Jeff, you care to venture a guess as to what this episode could be about?
If this was a Star Trek episode, it'd be about Klingons.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a Star Trek episode.
Mm-mm.
In this one, they're going to go to a planet.
Mm-hmm.
That's my prediction. No, they're going to go to a planet. There's going to be a royal family, essentially.
Okay.
And when they show up, there's going to be a usurper or someone with a claim. Like, I'm thinking season one Game of Thrones, right? Where, mm-hmm. where Ned is going through trying to track down all of Robert's bastard sons. For everything, it's going to be kind of similar to that, and it's going to be a question of, do the bloodlines rule, you know, and like, what is the right way to parse all of this out?
You're a good guesser, Jeff. You're a good guesser.
I keep saying that. One of these days I'm going to hit it. So
well, we are going to see next time exactly how close or far away Jeff is right here on Stargate SG-1 for the first time. Hey, thank you guys so much for joining us. Please, wherever you get your podcast, don't forget to subscribe. If you're joining us on YouTube, please don't forget to like as well as subscribe. Hit that bell icon. Share this video. Share the podcast. Best way to get the word out is through you. Word of mouth. Say, hey, I found this cool podcast and you guys would also enjoy it because you love Stargate SG-1 or you love Babylon 5 or you like Star Trek and here are these two Trekkies that are checking out these other two shows. Check us out. Or maybe you know somebody who needs to get into SG-1 for the first time and they just need somebody to do it with and we would be happy them to join us in our journey. That being said, we're going to get out of here. So thank you guys so much for joining us this week. We will see you right back here next week on
Stargate. Brent.
Yeah.
I got a question for you. It's kind of a style fashion question.
Mm.
Do you think I should put some clothes on or is it cool to just let this thing hang out?
Oh, for crying out loud.